Welcome to the CCFR Radio Podcast, your source for news, updates, and stories from the CCFR.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 103 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Rod Giltacka. Thanks for joining me again today on the podcast. I've got so much to talk about that I'm striking things off the list. I've done multiple takes on the intro to try to like how, I'm sitting here at 22, 25 minutes. I'm like, I'm not even finished. How am I going to do this? So I think what I may do is the things that I don't talk about or don't talk about completely, I'll address or readdress in the next podcast. And I think what I might do is do a podcast next week. So you might get, a podcast 2 weeks in a row. Don't hold me to that. I don't know if I have the time for it, but I'm going to try. Okay. Cause I think it's probably worth it, but there's so much going on in our community. I'm going to bring on Wilson. She's got a couple of updates. We're going to do the neon sign draw. We're going to talk about something really, really sensitive. So stay tuned for that. That'll be interesting. And as far as what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to answer some comments. A couple of them are going to take some time, but I'm really enjoying the comments and answering them because I enjoy answering questions. And the harder the question is, the more I enjoy answering it, because if I have to really explore something, especially something difficult, and I've had to really think about it again and take a second or third or a 150th thought on that topic, and it makes me a better decision maker. Keep the questions coming. Hopefully you're enjoying me answering, addressing some of the comments, because I'm really enjoying it because it really feels more like a conversation to me. I like that better than me just blabbing at you guys. So let me know if you like that, and because I want to continue to do it every podcast. And then I'm also going to address what's next for the CCFR, what we have planned this year. I can't talk about everything because, I like to keep things confidential until I'm right about to do them or we've done them, but I can share a couple of things. So before we get started, I'd like to talk about our sponsors, Vortex, the Force of Optics. So thanks very much to all our friends over at Vortex Canada for continuing to support the podcast. We really appreciate it. Check out all the great stuff at vortexcanada.net. That's vortexcanada.net. And of course, a huge thank you to our friends at the Saskatchewan Rivers chapter of Safari Club International. We really appreciate their ongoing support. You can check out all their great work at saskriversseci.com. That's saskriversseci.com. All right, let's get started. I've had to do multiple takes because it's taking so long, but this is really important stuff for us to talk about. So first thing, I want to address some comments because it's kind of fun. Kevin Smith. I talked about Kevin Smith's comment last time when I said, I guess he was saying, the government wants all your guns. They don't want us to have guns or whatever it was. I can't quite remember. And I said, no, you're not a conspiracy theorist, man. They're taking your guns. Like they're actually doing it. And, they're saying one thing and doing something completely different, too. So, no. So he says, thanks, Rod, for mentioning my comment. Most people think I'm a conspiracy theorist. You're not, Kevin, because for something to be a theory means that there is no evidence to support your claim, or you're in the process of getting supporting evidence. And I'm going to give you a little piece of some completely supporting evidence for your claims. A buddy of mine said that the assault weapons ban is no big deal. I told him, you're crazy if you think that that they will stop there. Now, your buddy's wrong. You're right, Kevin. And here's why. I'll give you an example that just happened. Just this past week, the Kodiak Defense KD-200, which is a bolt action rifle, was named prohibited by the firearms program and shows up now in regulation as a prohibited firearm. Why? I haven't looked into it, so I don't want to say definitively, but it's either because it looks like an assault style rifle. So we're, and this is not the first time, if that's the case, that a firearm has been classified based on what it looks like, which is basically based on emotion. So you're in upside down world. And it's interesting, like what in today's world is a conspiracy theory anymore? I don't know about you, but I'm living in bizarro world here. Stuff that so-called conspiracy theorists talked about 5 years ago is daily life right now. And half the population is not even blinking. So anyway, they've prohibited a bolt action rifle. So either it was looks like a scary rifle, the lower will go on another firearm that's semi-automatic. I'm not sure that it will. So I'll look into that. Maybe I'll have a definitive explanation for you next podcast. Or it uses an AR-15 trigger group, which is ridiculous. Just a bunch of springs and hammers and stuff and operating parts. Nothing in there can cause a bolt action to be semi-auto or full auto. So anyway, all of it's, no matter what their excuse is, it's ridiculous. So right there is a bolt action rifle, completely reasonable for hunting or sporting use, now prohibited for just pretty much no reason at all. So yeah, it's not a theory. It's actually happening. So it's just a verified claim now. And one thing I do want to draw your attention to is there was a line that was crossed, right? The Canadian government crossed the Rubicon when it comes to classifying firearms when they did the order and council gun ban. And the reason I say that is they created a new provision where they can prohibit firearms, declare them just too dangerous for a member of the public to own based on muzzle energy. Okay, so that's a real problem. Now that's a set of goalposts on rails so they can move the goalpost in and out wherever they need to ban a firearm that they have no other reason to ban. And so basically it's the ability to ban firearms based on how far they can shoot or how big the bullet is or how fast the bullet is coming out of the muzzle, all of those things. So now when the 50 cals and the 460s and the other firearm actions capable of firing cartridges that exceed the joule limit in the regulation, when all those are in distant memory, they'll be like, how can you justify a 7mm Remington Magnum? How can you justify a firearm that powerful? You don't need it. Any large game in Canada, any game around that's legal to be hunted in Canada can be taken with a 30-06 Springfield. You know, you don't need a 7mm Remington mag. It's ridiculous. You know, you could shoot a long way with it. Who needs a 338 Lapua? Like, that's ridiculous. Don't tactical teams use that now? They should be banned. So the goalposts keep coming closer all the way down to, you know, what are you going to end up with? A 17 HMR rimfire? Because, you know, just because. So these things aren't theories. They're showing you in real, definitive actions that this is exactly what they're doing. So, Kevin, you're not wrong. Okay. Antique Tractors and Equipment asks about, seems like the CCFR is getting stronger. How are the CCFR memberships doing and might be worth an update? So Antique Tractors and Equipment. So the answer to that is really when you're asking about membership numbers, different organizations call, they interpret their numbers differently. But when someone says, you know, how big is your membership? What they're asking me, in my opinion, is how much money do you guys have, right? How powerful are you financially? And what's your political influence? How many people will listen if you say, hey, I need your help, or here's what I'd recommend, or red alert, something's going wrong, you know, stand up and be counted. And when it comes to membership numbers, there's organizations out there that count all of their memberships, even, and the overwhelming majority of them are club members, meaning that they sell insurance to gun clubs. And as part of that, they issue a membership to every single person who's a membership of a gun club. The majority of those people may or may not even know that they're members of a firearm advocacy organization. Okay, so for someone, that's why I don't inflate my numbers by counting those people, because they didn't go to the website and input all their information, say, I want to send the CCFR money. I want to be a member because they speak for me, or I believe in what they do, or I want them to become more powerful. They don't have their attention. This is not a politically active individual. So when it comes to that, our membership numbers fluctuate widely because people may or may not renew their membership on time or renew it for 6 months. So our membership numbers, individual real members, fluctuate somewhere between 26,000 and 35,000. And depending on when you look at the numbers, so all over the place. And that's good and it's not good. It's not good because it makes it more difficult for me to plan spending money, because that's really our mandate, is to spend money doing things that will get you towards your goal of getting the government out of your life and keep holding on to your guns. But interesting, I just want to share this about the CCFR, is our list of people, our contact list of people that have sent us money or send us money. And these are donations anywhere from $1,000 to $20,000 a shot, right? Is probably between 55 and 70,000 people, somewhere in there. So as I understand our business better every year, more people send us money than buy a membership for some reason. I don't know whether people don't want to be on lists or what it is, but at the end of the day, the amount of people that I could send an email, like red alert, I need your help, I need you to do X, is probably between 50 and 70,000 people, I think, overall, somewhere in there. So if you want to know how strong the CCF are, that's probably the best way to measure it. And as far as money, I mentioned before, we're very transparent in how much money we bring in, how much money we spend, and where our money comes from. We brought in $3.4 million last year. That obviously, that's not profit. We make a lot less when you buy a t-shirt than when we get a, and we don't make all the money on a membership either. Our membership cost is somewhere around $10. So if you buy a membership for 40 bucks, the CCFR gets around $30 is what we have to work with to spend on projects, right? And that doesn't include staff or whatever. That's like just the cost of sending out the physical card that first time, or your renewal gift, a cost of, you know, postage, the gift itself, printing the letter, stuffing the envelope, sending them out, that kind of thing. So this year we're not going to do 3.4. Last year was a really, you know, anomalous year, but it was by far, probably by about 40% more than any firearm organization, to my knowledge, has ever brought in Canadian history. And I'm not talking about wildlife foundations. They get money from hunting licenses and stuff. People are forced to pay memberships in them for a variety of reasons. But I mean, voluntarily joined organization like ours. So, and that's why we could do things like distribute over 250,000 election brochures, right? Or get 66 billboards across the country, not full time, but, you know, rotating. The way, you know, that's the reason why we can do these big things, right? Television commercials, television shows, you know, that's the reason. So anyway, hopefully that's a complete answer. Now, there's a couple of, okay, I'm going to, CR Kant says, I'm going to try to make this quick because I'm already at like 12 minutes or something. I wish you'd report in your podcast how many viewers you had in the last podcast on all social medias where you're heard, because out of 2 million registered gun owners, I find it hard to believe that the podcast only got 10,000 views, basically. I wish this podcast would come up on Rumble because I avoid YouTube like the plague, probably for good reason. YouTube is a great audience for us. I know for a fact that other people have told me that YouTube, the Skype, that YouTube throttles down your views. I don't know if that's happening to us, but back when we could meet with people physically, everybody would be like, oh, I love the podcast. I'm like, how do you watch the podcast, right? Or listen to it? And it was like so many people. I was like, how could, you know, our numbers really aren't that high. But right now, between YouTube, between Facebook, because I upload the videos to Facebook separately so I can get the metrics from Facebook only instead of linking over to YouTube. And we have the podcast. So between all three platforms, well, and it's multiple platforms, there's the iTunes store, Apple Podcasts or whatever, and Spotify and all these different platforms there, we get between 14,000, 15,000 and 22,000 to 24,000 views or listens to every podcast that we do, which is on average, you know, anywhere from 17 to 20,000, I guess, on average, views every 2 weeks, which is really good. The more, the better. But that's what we're getting as far as I know, YouTube being most of it. And maybe we're being throttled on YouTube. Maybe it's 15 to 20,000 on YouTube alone. I have no idea. But anyway, if you don't forget to share the podcast, because we want to expand that audience. So anyway, hopefully that, now when it comes to Rumble, yeah, that was the one that I was like, I had something else I was going to say. We have a new social media strategy that we have spent a long time developing, and you're going to see that in the next few weeks, probably. So that may or may not include Rumble, may or may not include some other platforms, but we're going to diversify where you can find our content and make sure that people know that it's there. So anyway, I just haven't had a chance to implement that, but that's on the medium burner, if not the front burner. Okay. Now this last one. Oh, here's a quick one. Consciousness M says, I'm still waiting to hear an update about a court case. I talk about the court case sometimes, but I'm going to put a link in the description box just for you, Consciousness M, so that you can look. We published the entire court schedule already on the website. There's a web link for you below so you can see exactly where everything's at. Okay, so I have to stop the comment analysis right here because I answered two more comments, one from Liberty in Peril and Misfit, and I answered them together, and it was a really worthwhile conversation I had. I guess we're all a diatribe, right? It's a one-way conversation. But it was really interesting, and I think it was valuable. So I'm going to bring that up again in another podcast. And it just exhausted me. Like I had to do like 7 takes because it's a hard thing to talk about. So look forward to that. Maybe in the next podcast, maybe next week, I'll insert that there. But I had a couple more things I want to talk about really quickly. Number one was Toronto Police Service Chief Raymer was, I guess, doing a press conference for something. And I think Global News had asked him where all these crime guns in his jurisdiction were coming from. I'm sure you've seen this video, but in case you haven't, check it out.
On the gun violence, how do you think
they're getting
the guns?
Well, our statistics show that the vast majority of them, and I think it's closing in on 80%, if the number's not there, are coming in from the United States. And so we do a lot of enforcement with our partners throughout the province to sort of work on those type of investigations to stop as much as that we can. But it's very, very difficult. You know, we live in a country with the largest undefended border, with a significant gun culture in the United States. And it's a very difficult issue that we need to address.
Okay, 80%. I theorize that it was actually more than 80% because I subscribe to the Toronto Police Off the Streets Twitter feed. I think that's what it's called. But basically, when they take a gun off the streets, they take a picture of it and they tweet it out. And the overwhelming majority of those pictures, and everybody always comments on them. They always get commented, you know, wall to wall. It's like, this is a prohib. This doesn't exist legal in Canada. Obviously, yet another smuggled gun. And the overwhelming majority of the ones they show pictures of, if they're not some rusty thing that came out of somewhere, they even had a muzzle loader there. We all had a good time with that. You know, I guess Jack Sparrow is now in custody kind of thing. Captain Jack. But anyway, yeah, they're always prohibs on there. Almost always, right? Guns come from other sources, for sure. But anyway, look forward to that 80% number to be completely ignored. In fact, I'll mention one more thing. When Bill Blair was still the minister of skullduggery on behalf of Justin Trudeau, he had a website commissioned for the government, and that website was like, you know, public, you know, how we're making Canada safe against gun violence. And one of the sections, I still have it here, and it's still live. It says how guns can be diverted and end up in violent crime. Out of the three areas, which do you think is the first one? Usually you'd have like, this is where most of the guns come from, the majority. This is the next, you know, in volume, and this is the last one, right? What do you think was the first thing they talked about? Straw purchasing. That's the first one. And I know for a fact, because facts are facts, either something's true or not, that it's the percentage of law-abiding gun owners that engage in straw purchasing in Canada is somewhere in the order of 1/100th of 1%, right? It was 7/1000th of 1% based on our research. And so it's got to be more than that because not all of them get caught. But yeah, 1/100th of 1% of gun owners. And certainly not more than 1% or a fraction of 1% of overall guns on average across the country are straw purchased crime guns, you know, come from that area. It's just the way it is. Now in different jurisdictions, it's different. Like I know in Edmonton, it's very high because they have one or two people that straw purchased a bunch of guns and sold them all into the black market. And that can happen, certainly. But by no means is it the problem that it's made out to be by Bill Blair, much less the number one. It's like a distant, almost insignificant third place. But anyway, I thought it was worth mentioning. Look forward to that 80% figure from Chief Raymer to be widely ignored by basically everybody but us. Next thing I want to talk about is the Baldwin shooting. Now, I don't want to talk about it too much, but it's just there's two areas of irony here. It's kind of interesting. Everybody knows all about this story. It's been a big story for a while. So I don't want to get too into it, but it kind of leads me to two interesting ironies and also an experience that I just had 2 weeks ago. So basically, Alec Baldwin is a really highly accomplished actor. He's a very talented, high-level actor, okay? But as a person, he seems to be a complete mess and completely broken. And many celebrities are because, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I think that people aren't meant to get that much attention. We weren't designed for that. And I think it just drives people insane. And we see that with the Prime Minister of Canada as a great example, and Alec Baldwin as well, just completely nuts in that if there's a train going somewhere and you're going to be seen on the train by a lot of people, like I'm on the train, I don't care what kind of train it is, why it's heading in that direction, why it shows up now, I'm not going to wait to know where it's even going. I'm jumping on because I can be seen on that train and other people will be the ones watching me, right? So that's virtue signaling. So back in 2017, check it out. Alec Baldwin tweets, "I wonder how it must feel to wrongfully kill someone. And he posts some story about what he thinks or what may be. I don't know the case. I didn't look this situation up, but a police officer wrongfully shooting somebody. Wow. Very interesting. So it's quite ironic because, you know, 4 years later, he's the one wrongfully killing somebody. And apparently in his mind, it's not his fault, right? Or at least that's what it seems like. So, and the other thing that's ironic is it's a police officer that he's saying, like, look at this wrongful shooting. And it may have been a wrongful shooting. I don't know. Right. But it may not have been. And a lot of times in these situations, you have to wait because you don't know anything other than the way it looks on Twitter or on the news. And you don't know anything about that stuff. So you never, ever start yapping if you don't know what's going on, you know, especially when it comes to somebody getting killed. You have to be very sensitive to that. So anyway, but he's like, oh, look at how bad the police are and how they wrongfully kill somebody. And then what, 2 days ago, he says, oh, you know what? I think the movie industry should have police officers take charge on movie sets of firearm safety. And this is insane, right? Because on a lot of different levels. And I'll tell you, I'm not a movie armorer. So, you know, bear that. And so I'm just going to, as a professional, I don't like calling myself an expert and stuff, but I'm an expert when it comes to firearm safety and firearm training, right? And from a training perspective, so again, I'm not an armorer, but from a training perspective, the way I look at it is if you want to have a safe set for a movie, then you hire a real armorer. And you certainly don't hire a person that would allow live ammunition anywhere near the property where you're shooting a movie, where people are pointing actual firearms at each other and pulling the trigger. You would never do that. Don't hire people like that. And apparently, and again, I don't know this, but apparently, allegedly, there were safety people walking off the set because of safety concerns before this happened. If you're a responsible leader on a set like that, just like I'm a responsible leader at a training course, somebody does something unsafe, it's over, man. They're done. It's over. And if you have to pay more to have a real professional armorer on set so that people live through the production, then that's what you do. That's how you solve that problem. The last thing you do is bring a police officer on set who is, police officers are not experts. They're barely generalists when it comes to firearm safety. They're not trained for that stuff. They're generalists. They're trained for lots of other things, right? It's not an easy job. You got to know a bit about a lot of different things. There's a huge volume of stuff that you need to know just to operate at a mediocre level as a police officer. Firearm safety isn't one of those things. Police officers are qualified and barely at, you know, when it comes to just the training that they get by a department, they're barely qualified on a handgun, a semi-automatic handgun, and maybe a shotgun, and maybe later in their career on a semi-automatic AR pattern rifle. Like, that's it. They don't get any training on any other firearms. Okay, I know that for a fact because I've trained anywhere from 3 to 5, maybe 600 police officers, overwhelmingly RCMP officers. And I know in depot, they don't get that training because after every either firearm familiarity class or Canadian firearm safety course class that I've done for them, specifically just all of police officers are always like, they have to extend depot by 2 days and they need to bring you in to Saskatchewan to teach this course or a familiarity training on all these different kinds of firearms. Cause I have never seen any of that. You know, I see them and it's not unusual for us to take a loaded firearm from a scene to the detachment or to the office loaded in the trunk of our car. Cause we can't open it up to prove it safe. So I know that this is something I'm talking. Cause I know this is a fact. Now there's a lot of police officers, RCMP included, that are firearm owners, like outside of their job, and they're great. They're experts. You know, equal to or far better than me, but that's not the norm, right? Case in point. So for the first time in my life, I decided 2 weeks ago that I was going to turn some firearms into the RCMP. Never did that before because I never would let go of firearms. Well, I had a bunch of training firearms and one live one that I just didn't need anymore. They're worthless. Barrels are drilled out. The actions are, you know, drilled out and the firing pin's not in there. You can never fire a live round again. I just don't need all of them. And three of them were restricted. They were handguns. And those are on my license, right? So I'm like, I never disposed of guns before. So I'm like, oh, what do I do? Do I turn in the three restricteds and then throw the non-restricteds into the river or what? Like, I'm like, do I take them to the dump, cut them in half or something, get a chop saw, cut them in half? I'm like, I'll just call the RCMP and turn them in. you know, I'll see what that process is like. It was awesome. I loved it, actually. So I called up the RCMP and they made me a priority for some reason. They're like, oh, you want to turn in guns? No problem. We'll be right there. I'm like, that's how to get some fast service. But anyway, so the member shows up and it was everything my experience. It was consistent with all my experience, right? It was everything you'd expect. Great guy comes in. He's like, okay, I'm here for the guns. I'm like, awesome. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to handle any firearms with you. I want you to feel comfortable. I've got the registration certificates here and, you know, we'll work with each other to get through the process. And he's like, okay. So he, you know, I have all the firearms, you know, on a blanket and he picks up a hinge or break action firearm, right? Break action. So he picks up and he's like, and he fumbles around with it for, I don't know, about 2 minutes. And he's like, can you tell me how to open this thing? I'm like, do you want me to help you? Cause I don't want to handle any guns. I want you to be comfortable. And he's like, absolutely help me. I'm like, okay, this is a hinge. So I had to kind of hold a class, right? This is a hinge or break action firearm. No ammunition can be nowhere in the firearm, but the chamber. Right? No magazine, no nothing. I said, here's the action release. Open it up. I said, I'm going to look into the chamber through the barrel and I can see it's clear. Do you agree? And I hold it up to him. He's like, yeah, it's clear. I'm like, okay, great. Now it's safe. And he goes, do you have any tie wraps or zap straps? And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, just to kind of make these safe. I'm like, oh, I go downstairs. I grab tie wraps for him. I'm like, okay. And I said, with this one, there's no way to lock this firearm to make it safe other than we need to just tie wrap the trigger. If you want me to do that, that's fine. Or put a tie wrap around the action while it's still open so you can't close it. So we chose to do each one of these break actions differently. So we got some experience there. And so we went through the whole thing, helped him record all the information, whatever. And then he's ready to go. And I'm like, do you want me to help you carry these out? And he's like, sure. So he says, do you have any cases? I'm like, I ain't giving you any cases. I don't buy cases to give you to go destroy someplace or throw in the garbage. I'd get them for my own guns. He's like, okay, never mind. I'm like, all right. So, so we threw them all in the back of the police car and off he went. And those three restricteds are off my license and the long guns are disposed of properly. There was not even parts that were usable, right? Cause I don't typically throw away guns, but yeah, I mean, it was everything that I would expect it would be, but I would have to say that I really appreciated that. They came right to the house. I got rid of those guns. I know they're not going to end up in the wrong place. Well, chances are they won't. And then I got a little bit more room in the gun room. So that was that. So anyway, interesting that Baldwin, in his quest for solutions to, you know, oh, I'm here to make it, you know, better next time. Forget about hiring real armors. We'll get the police involved, the police that I don't trust to not wrongfully shoot people, right? So anyway, I thought that was interesting. Hopefully it was interesting to you. All right, enough of my blabbering. Let's get Tracy Wilson on. All right, on Skype, we've got Wilson. Wilson!
Kiltaka! That's my normal greeting now when I go anywhere or even into the kitchen, the children are yelling, Wilson!
Oh yeah, it's caught on, has it?
Yeah. Wildfire.
So the first thing we're going to talk about something kind of sensitive, which is that Roger Kutenko, who's a gunsmith in rural Ontario, was killed by ERT a few days ago.
Yeah. So the story's been in the news a lot. Of course, there's been a couple stories out about it. There isn't a lot of information out other than the fact that he was a licensed gunsmith. Rural Ontario, about 150 miles outside of TPS territory, although they were the ones executing the warrant. He had a customer with him. He was working out of his shop, which is located at his home, and his wife was also home. Those are kind of the things we know. There's an awful lot we don't know.
Yeah. So a lot of people have been messaging us, a lot of people messaging me, asking, why are you guys silent on this? And that because I criticize people all the time for not having anywhere near enough facts to form a real opinion. And then they're getting into arguments with other people about, you know, their impression or, you know, whatever they filled in the blanks about on a topic. And it's very difficult. It doesn't really take you anywhere, right? So right now we don't really know much. What we do know is a lot of people have sent us messages, both on social media, email, all that stuff, talking about what a great guy this guy was, how reliable he was. And that he had a relationship with the CFO's office, that he had a relationship with the OPP and worked on guns for them. So yeah. The whole thing does stink based on what we know now, but we don't know everything now. So, you know, I'm going to reserve a lot of comment until we do know more about this. And it could be a while because, somebody was killed in this incident, and a lot of investigation goes into these kinds of situations before information is released to the public. But certainly people should be demanding answers. I'm not sure that the CCFR is, it's not our mandate to be a police watchdog. Our mandate is to educate the public, do public relations, interface with government, stuff like that. Not that this isn't important. I will, however, make a couple of comments on what we do know, and basically talk about a couple of things that are really bothersome about the situation. So I have a little bit of experience in these areas, not the most experience in Canada, but I know a little bit about these things. And it's very curious why ERT was used. So they know that this guy was a gunsmith. They know that if they burst, that he works from home, that if they burst into his home, chances are he's got a gun in his hand. Just like if you burst into a Canadian Tire garage looking for people with wrenches, you're probably going to find somebody with a wrench in their hand. They're a mechanic, right?
Right.
And when you use ERT, and I know a lot of people have been messaging like, Rod, don't you remember you had mentioned, you know, you'd made a claim about ERT being sent and people getting hurt to confiscate guns from otherwise law-abiding people. And I'm not ready to take that credit yet because this might be more complex. So we don't know what Roger was into. We don't know that he was completely innocent. We're going to assume that he was. And if we assume that he was, and I'm completely comfortable with doing that, then this looks terrible. So when you use ERT for a call, if you've got someone, a random criminal that you know is prone to violence, that's what ERT is for, because people get hurt when ERT gets called, you know, quite often because there's a threat. If this guy is a licensed gun owner, gets a criminal background check every day, has a relationship with the CFO at whatever level, like I do with the CFO, I'm an instructor still, has a relationship with the OPP, worked on their guns, is running a business overtly from his home that everybody knows about, that doesn't look like a threat to me. So if you just wanted to talk to him about some storage compliance or something like that, you'd probably be okay to send a general duty member there. And if not, if he's an actual threat, you know, and you're worried about that, then you would send ERT. But in my experience, again, you know, it's whatever, it is what it is. If you're really worried about somebody and you believe them to be a threat and they're a gunsmith and you know that they have a house full of guns and you know he might be holding a gun when you break in, you also have a duty for that person's safety as well. You'd probably A, put him under surveillance to make sure that he was alone in the house at the time, which he wasn't, or you would take him into custody outside the home. You'd wait, you'd put him under surveillance and you'd wait until he went to the grocery store or something by himself and you'd pull him over at a traffic stop where he wouldn't reasonably have a gun in his hand. So right. These are things that good high-level ERT teams and good police agencies, right, and competent team leaders, ERT team leaders, these are the things that they think about beforehand. So this whole thing looks really, really ugly from the outside. Anyway, so our condolences to Mr. Katenko's family and to everyone that knew him. I've gotten a lot of messages about what a great guy he was, and he was a sports shooter and all the rest of that stuff. So really unfortunate situation. We'll keep an eye on it. All right. So a new shadow cabinet has been finally chosen by the Conservatives. What's going on there?
Yeah. So talk about leaving it to the last the last minute here. I said in the last podcast that any day I was hoping for the announcement of the shadow cabinet. It took a little longer than I thought, but finally it has arrived. So we've got a new shadow minister for public safety. And for those of you that haven't heard, that's Raquel Doncho. So she's kind of a rookie MP. She was elected in 2019, but she's been quite the superstar since elected. She comes from a small rural farming community in Manitoba. She was a political science major. She's a very young, competent voice for rural Canada. And I think, although she may not have a ton of experience in the public safety file itself, I think she really kind of understands rural people and some of the issues that affect them, which would, of course, include gun ownership. I reached out to her yesterday right away, been in contact, talking to some of the other MPs that also work on the file, and they feel pretty confident about her appointment. So I'm really excited to see her go up against Mendocino, to be perfectly honest. She's very, very competent and talented. So I'm excited about that. And then our friend Bob Zimmer actually got a nice appointment too. He got shadow minister of Northern Affairs and Arctic Sovereignty, as well as Northern Economic Development Agency. So that's kind of really important for Northern Canada. It's a great file for Bob. Issues that are dear to his heart. And of course, you know, there's still kind of a loose connection with the rural or northern element. And of course, gun ownership, which is really important to people in northern communities. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So those are the people that we'd be watching things on our behalf. On to the next thing. The Gunny Girl calendar is coming out soon. When does it come out, by the way?
Well, we are a little bit late. I'm going to admit that right off the bat. We've had a lot of issues. This is a big project, right? We do pictures in Ontario, pictures in Alberta, pictures all over, trying to get them together, get the edits done, get it built, edit different versions of it. We've dragged on a little bit. So it looks like today we finally have our final version. Our graphic designer has been working with the printer all morning, just getting this laid out. But this is cool. There's a couple of things that are really new this year. Number one, we've always traditionally featured one girl per month. We do a 13-month calendar, so it runs from December to the following December. And then, of course, we feature one girl on the cover. And usually how we pick that is either it's somebody that's gone over and above in our community or just, you know, the most kick-ass picture we could find. But we're doing something a little different. We had such an enormous outpouring of girls who really wanted to be involved. And it's very difficult because basically we have to narrow it down to 14 pictures, which is almost impossible. So what we've done this year is we've got some pages that are actually group shots, which is new. We've never done that before. The cover is a group shot that we did out in Alberta. It features all the girls from the Alberta photo shoot. And then there will be 3 months on the inside that feature more than one girl. Now, that still didn't allow for enough space to feature all the incredible women who wanted to participate in this project. So you're going to get a little added bonus in your calendar this year. You're going to have a poster inserted in. So basically, it'll be the size of 4 pieces of paper, so 17 by 22. It'll be folded and then folded in half again. And on one side, it'll feature a whole bunch of really cool photos that were just so awesome. I feel bad that we couldn't get everything in the calendar that we wanted to. So this is a great way to get them out there. And then on the flip side of that poster, that'll be, you know, full of girls on one side. On the other side, it'll sort of be a generic promotional CCFR poster, you know, something that you would maybe want to hang up at your club or whatever. So whether you wanted to see, you know, the girls for the whole year on one side of the poster or flip it around and have the CCFR, that's entirely up to you. It also works perfect if you've got a glass door at your club between, you know, two rooms. You could put it on there, see the girls from one side and the CCFR stuff from the other. So that's an added bonus in this year's calendar, brand new. It will be going to print before the end of the week. So I should be able to start going and picking them up next week and get them in the store. So by next Friday, fingers crossed, unless anything crazy happens, it should be for sale in the stores. So in time for Christmas.
Yeah, the whole thing looks really awesome. And I don't know, we've probably talked about it before, right? But I'm not a fan of this project for a bunch of different reasons. I think it's actually quite controversial. And then
it is.
And then even the other side of it, right? I photographed two of the girls myself because they were West Coast people. And it was just cost effective for me to do that. And one of them was actually here at the CCFR studio, which is kind of cool.
Yes.
But even then, you know, I photographed these girls. I'm like, you know, talking to you and I'm like, did my girls get in? You know, it's like now I'm advocating. And now I'm like, well, you know, these girls came out and they brought all their stuff and they better be in there. And I'm like, oh, the pressure and the conflict with everybody, you know, because and as I don't know if we explained before, but you have to have more girls than you do months because sometimes the pictures don't work out or something happens and you don't have enough. So you have to have too many people, but then not everybody gets in and they all put in equal effort. So it's just right. It's a really prickly difficult project on so many levels. But anyway, the end product, I just saw the poster and it looks beautiful. It looks awesome. All the pictures are so great.
Oh yeah. And the girls are so fun. And it's a great fundraiser. A lot of people are saying, you know, I hope you print more. It sells out too quick. And I think last year we printed 1500 copies. And they were gone, I think, in a week and a half. So yes, we have increased that to 2,500 copies for the public. We've got 100 copies on the side over and above that for people who helped with the project and photographers and people who offered locations and guns and cars and bikes and all kinds of things to us. But yeah, there'll be 2,500 available to the public. I still, you know, people are like, well, why don't you just print as many as you possibly could? I still want to keep it competitive because it is a lottery ticket as well. I'm doing draws every month. People are winning prizes or winning guns or winning all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's special. If you get a hold of one of these, it's like your little lottery ticket for the year. At the same time, you're supporting the women's program. So, yeah, so we did print more, but it will still be a limited time offer. So,
well, it's not really a lottery.
Watch our social media. I will be plastering that everywhere as soon as they're available.
Yeah, it's not really a lottery. It's a contest. But anyway.
It's a contest. Yeah.
We have to be careful about that. But yeah, it looks really great. You get a poster and everything. How much are they retail?
$25.
$25. It's a fundraiser. You get, there's free draws if you buy a calendar, and, well worth it. So if you haven't bought one before, consider it. It's a really nice calendar.
Yeah. And all the funds that we raise by selling these calendars is what we use to fund our ladies' range days to introduce more women to the sport who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity. So yeah,
really valuable thing. Yeah. Okay. Now the last thing we got to do is the neon sign draw. So we were late on the last one. So I know it seems like we're, you know, right away doing another one, but all right. So there's a sign we showed that last time.
Yeah. And who wants it? It's right here. I'm going to package this up today and get it out. I'm excited. Let's see who wins.
It's awesome.
This is the big one too. And it says the, these guns are not for sale, and it's in red and white. So it's really cool. It's the two-tone like this one. So very, very nice.
All right. So here is the, here's the spreadsheet. We got to figure out how many lines. I think it was at the end there. Okay. We've got line one through line 1221, 1 through 1221.
All right. This is exciting. I love sending these out. People get so excited and 12, post pictures. Whoever wins, you have to tag me in a picture.
All right. 1 through 1221 and generate 265. 265. Ooh. All right.
Let's go see.
Oh, here we go. 265 right here. And I'm going to go back before I reveal the last name on this.
Mm-hmm.
265 is Mike Sibley from Keswick, Ontario. Mike Sibley.
Oh, Keswick. Perfect.
Keswick. Cool. I don't know where that is, but it sounds like there's a neon sign winner in the neighborhood
there
over there.
There's a neon sign winner in Keswick. Yeah.
Awesome. Congratulations, Mike. And thank you so much for your support. As I was looking down that list, there's so many people that bought multiple $10 denomination donations to the CCFR. And for that, thank you very much. And I really appreciate your support.
Now we're going to have a new sign up, right?
Yep. That new sign.
What's the next one? I think
it's a CCFR radio one. So you can see that in the background. And so that one's the next one. And it's about as big as the one that you held up. Like, they're really, really big. So if you are interested in that sign, you can make a donation to the CCFR. Right now, that one has already started, I think, 2 days ago, because it's supposed to start on the same date each month. But anyway, as I mentioned before, the contest kind of got screwed up a little bit because I was having some other issues that I had to attend to and was a little bit behind in some things. So, yeah.
But we're going to keep going all through 2021. We're going to light it right up. So, this is a great opportunity to get your hands on one of these cool neon signs and at the same time help support the CCFR.
Yeah. And, you know, I will mention one more thing. To get a CCFR radio sign, that might be more of a significant win in the next little while than you think it is. It might, that sign might be a little bit more famous than you think it is right now, but I'm going to leave that for now because, you know, my plans may or may not work out, but yeah.
I know. Well, that's such a tease. You're such a tease on that.
I have detailed plans. Yeah.
Okay. There are plans.
Yes. Awesome. Well, thanks for updating us on all that, Tracy, and we'll see you next time.
All right. We'll talk soon.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of the CCFR Radio Podcast. That was a long one. It took an entire day to do this podcast. So anyway, the comments were long. We had so much to talk about. I tried to make it as short as possible, but thank you for hanging in there if you're listening to this right now. The one thing I didn't cover was what's next for the CCFR, some of the projects that we got going on. I'm going to save that for the next podcast. If at all possible, I'm going to try to do one next week. No promises on that. If not, you'll have to wait for the 2 weeks. And, you know, if you want to become a member of the CCFR, please consider doing that. You can do that at firearmrights.ca. You can also donate $10 or increments of $10. You get a free entry into the contest for the neon sign if you do that. And I'd really, really appreciate the support. Other than that, thanks, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you soon.
This is another episode of the CCFR Radio Podcast. Remember, if you don't stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms, who will? Join the CCFR or donate right now at www.firearmrights.ca.